Hello, hello, and welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the Rhodes Policing Unit before going into CID and Child Protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think. The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion. Well, hello, hello, and welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. This is our first show in which we invite a guest to discuss policing matters with us. Our guest today joined the police in 1985 and has served as a detective at every rank. He has had numerous roles, including being in charge of the robbery squad, the major crime unit and Matrix, tackling gun and gang-enabled crime. As an area commander, he was instrumental in reducing crime and antisocial behaviour. He continued to rise through the ranks, ultimately becoming the chief constable of a tough metropolitan area. During his tenure, he oversaw the biggest reorganisation in its history, making it the best-performing metropolitan force. He has held some of the highest risk portfolios in policing and was the national police lead on crime. He's been commended on 10 occasions, has received the King's Police Medal, and is a deputy lieutenant. He's also an adjunct professor within the School of Justice Studies at a leading university. He is currently His Majesty's Chief Inspector of Constabulary and Fire and Rescue Service. Andy Cook, a very warm welcome to A Thin Blue Mind today. It's a privilege to have you. There's a lot been in the news recently about the police service of the United Kingdom. Where do you think we are with it at the moment?
I think the first point to make very clear is that I honestly still believe that this is the best police service in the world. Every day we see officers and staff doing professional, courageous, brave, compassionate acts. But it can't be denied that there are a number of issues in policing at the moment, some of which have been brought to light through, unfortunately, officers being brought to justice in very high-profile ways, and quite rightly, and others in relation to reports done by the inspectorate and other people that have highlighted some key concerns around policing. Confidence and satisfaction is probably the key one at the moment. And we do, unfortunately, have the lowest levels of confidence and satisfaction in the police that I can remember. And that's over, as you said at the start, a long, long period of time. Policing has a window now to start ensuring that it gets that confidence and satisfaction back. And that's not just about getting the vetting right, getting the complaint system right, making sure those people who should never wear a police uniform don't get in the first place, and removing those who shouldn't still be wearing the uniform. It goes far deeper than that. The confidence and trust goes into the fact that we've got the lowest outcome levels at the moment, the lowest detection rates, the lowest charge rates for a long, long time, probably the lowest ever, although I can't definitively say that, but certainly in the last 10 years, charge rates have reduced by 2/3. So not enough people who need to be brought to justice are being brought to justice. And that period of austerity that really resulted in some forces removing a lot of that neighbourhood policing approach. And look, I'm a career detective. Neighbourhood policing is intrinsic to the fabric of the way we police in this country. You've got to have a strong neighbourhood policing approach. A lot of that was removed, which has resulted in some of the problems I think that we're seeing at the moment with that drop in confidence and satisfaction. Policing needs to get the basics right. It needs to ensure that it's doing the right things for all its communities, not just some of its communities, but all of its communities right across the country. And at the moment, we still have that some forces performing well, some performing not so well. I mean, it's no secret that the six forces currently in engage what people might call special measures. That's not because the forces in total are failing. That's because, quite simply, there are things within that force that's in engage that is causing me a concern to both public safety and public confidence. So a lot of challenges for police. I mean, we could go through finance, we could go through, you know, technology, we could go through 101 things. But it's always about remembering that balance, that the vast majority of police officers are doing the best on a daily basis. The system doesn't always help them to do that.
It's a long charge sheet that you read out, but that nicely perhaps informs us the role that you have and the organisation that you work for, perhaps for people that aren't aware.
Yeah, His Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary and His Majesty's Inspectorate of Fire and Rescue Service, which is awfully long titles, obviously. It's even worse when you put His Majesty's Chief Inspector of that in front of it. Basically, I mean, we inspect police forces and we inspect fire services. Not just in England and Wales, but overseas as well, some overseas territories. And we also, it's not just the Home Office forces, but it's BTP, we do PSNI, we do Ministry of Defence, Civil Nuclear and various other, and the NCA and various other agencies as well. We're not a regulator, we're inspectors, so we can't make anyone do anything. We make recommendations in relation to policing to ensure that, and fire to ensure that it is serving the public as well as it can, and it's effective, efficient, and it's got legitimacy. I have a team of about 350 people plus associates who do that across England and Wales, or based across England and Wales. And we look at both PEEL, which is obviously the police efficiency, effectiveness and legitimacy, which every force goes through every 2 years. And we do thematic inspections. We do inspections with other criminal justice partners. We do child protection inspections. There's numerous inspections that we do over that period of time. So it's not just PEEL, which everyone seems, you know, thinks of, or the thematics. There's a lot of other inspections that we do through that as well. I have up to four HMIs who work with me, who have different regions or national responsibilities, and sitting below them are an awful lot of really good people, both civil servants and secondees from policing and fire and rescue, who support those inspections. So it's a good team, it's a professional team, and it's there to serve the public more than to serve policing and to serve the fire and rescue services. The focus has always got to be on community. Just to be very clear, I mean, look, I was exceptionally proud to be a cop for 36 years, but there's no old boys network or old girls network about this. If policing needs to be criticised, if fire and rescue needs to be criticised, I will criticise them, because the public are always at the forefront of my thoughts.
Just holding on to that theme then about the public confidence. I'd be interested in your thoughts. You've said before that chief officers should have the power to decide who works for their organisation. With that in mind, do you think the role of police officer will change to that of an employee?
I think it's New Zealand who've made police officers employees reasonably recently. There's no massive call for it at the moment. But I do think if police officers are to retain that status as Crown servants, which brings that operational independence with it, we need to ensure, as I mentioned before, that the right people are in policing. Because it can be too difficult to remove people, whether that's in the first 2 years or whether that's in later on in the career. And everyone wants those people who shouldn't be there to go. Now, I understand why there are greater protections for police officers, because police officers can't strike, you know. But the whole process of trying to remove those officers who shouldn't be and staff who shouldn't be within policing can take far too long. So, you know, you've got your lawyers coming on both sides. It's unlike any other sort of employee where you wouldn't have a lawyer in the room. It'd just be a disciplinary process. I wouldn't personally want to see police officers as employees, because I cherish that policing by consent, operational independence, Crown servant title of being a police officer, because it does give you that independence. But police officers also have great powers. So that balance has got to be there. So before I think any considerations are given around making police officers employees, we need to sort out the whole discipline system of policing and make it not easier, because, you know, it can't be unfair to the police officer involved, but it's got to be fair, but far more streamlined than it is.
And I suppose it's the entry gate rather than the exit gate that we need to concentrate on. I'll touch that, if I may, in a minute about the many recommendations you've made in relation to vetting and actually not letting the bad people in the first place, so we don't have to then go through a process of getting rid of them at the other side.
Absolutely.
You touched on it a little before. Would you, as the head of HMICFRS, like to see the role include regulation powers?
It's something that I consider quite often. There's a big gap between us making recommendations. I mean, police forces and fire services don't have to follow them, but they do, generally, because they know what the consequences are if they don't.
Yeah.
As I say, we've got six forces in Engage at the moment. The Home Secretary stepping in with her powers and the powers that I have. So if there was to be further powers for myself as the Chief Inspector, probably around the power of direction. So rather than, you know, saying there's your recommendation, more of a direction of you must do this. And there are probably a few other nuances around that as well, in relation to the role that, for instance, the inspectorate has around appointments of chiefs and senior officers. It used to have a big role. It doesn't have a role now. That was changed in 2012, because obviously the leadership of policing needs to be right if we're going to ensure that the rest of the forces that they lead are doing the right things.
Sorry. So do you find then that in the majority of cases with chief constables, you're pushing against an open door with the recommendations that you make? Because you touched on it, that they know what will happen if they don't.
Yeah. It's a jar. It's not open. Right. Yeah. It depends on the chief. I would say this, wouldn't I? The smarter chiefs have full engagement with the inspectorate. Yeah. We're there all the time. We're in and out, and there's good relationships, and we know exactly what's going on. They bring to our attention the bad things that are happening, so there's no surprises. Yeah. And that's the way an inspectorate works best, with that openness on both sides. But having that extra powers director thing would just give it a bit more leverage in relation to the speed of things changing.
And I think that's happened in other areas in the financial system, even the advertising areas as well, where people have kind of had an inspectorate or a sign-up, if you want to, kind of process, and it's only really come into effect when there's actually been some stick with the carrot.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, there is a stick, but it maybe it's not big enough.
Okay. Are 43 police forces too many for you to inspect, or would it be easy for you if there were some low-hanging fruit for merging?
It would be easier because you're dealing with less chief constables. The same can be said about the fire service. I mean, you know, there's even more fire services than police forces. Personal view, too many fire services and police forces in this country. There's no political will to change that. I can't see it happening. So I think more importantly is forces and services need to work better together. They need to sort out those cross-border issues. They need to be in police inside more linked in through the regional organised crime units. And they need to get the technology right, because it doesn't often speak to each other very well when it should do. And forces by different systems to do things that may not talk to the neighbours, etc., etc. It's a pretty complex situation. If you were to start again, you know, if you were to say, oh, let's go and start everything again, you wouldn't start with 43 police forces, no. But it's just not going to change.
No, and I think it comes down to the day-to-day minutiae of police vehicles, kit, and just people have different ideas for their area.
They do, and that you've also got the issue around council tax. I mean, you know, getting that right in both areas, and getting the finance and funding right. And also, don't forget, you've got 43 politicians who lead alongside chiefs, because they're not the boss of the chiefs, who lead alongside chiefs. And I'm sure they're not too keen to actually pack in the jobs.
No. I'll just ask you one more, if I may. You've said also, and the stats bear it out, there's roughly 40% of police officers are women. Is that proportion high enough to combat misogyny, both internally and externally? And I'm thinking of an eye on, this is a big focus of the public, I would say, to really gain the public confidence and satisfaction back with some very recent high-profile cases.
I think it's to be welcomed, the fact that there are more women coming into policing, that the recent uplift has seen an even bigger percentage coming in, which is good to see. You always need the balance. You do need the balance, though. Yeah, you need a real balance across the whole workforce. Will that stop misogyny per se? No, it won't. We see in forces that are led by female chief constables that are still the same issues that are running through. Obviously, you bring more women in, it does change the dynamic of the force in question. But per se, no, it won't. An awful lot needs to be done on top of that to actually stop some of the cultural issues that we're seeing, including really strong leadership, really strong support for junior supervisors, who know if they do challenge, they're going to get supported further up the line. A real determination not to allow the sort of, well, I know he's a good bobby, so we'll do all we can to protect him. Yeah, because good bobbies are only good bobbies if they can work in the time that they're working in. Yeah. I mean, I know many, many bobbies who would struggle these days from when I was a young bobby. Yeah, and that's not a criticism of them, but it's a different time, it's a different age, and people need to keep up with the changes. So we can't have this closing ranks around people who speak up. We can't have this shunning of people who speak up because they think they're doing the right thing, particularly younger in service. And in the question you're asking, younger in service female officers, they've got to have a voice to be heard. So forces need to make sure that they are heard. They need full support, and supervisors who supervise them need the full support in doing that as well.
Great. Well, thank you. I've just got, in the style of Colombo, just it's one more thing. Yeah. You about to say that?
I did.
Now, since retirement, I run a police advice to TV and film business.
Yeah.
And which complements some acting work that I was supported in the job to do, which was great. Your favourite police officer on TV?
He's not on TV anymore, but Jack Regan.
Jack Regan.
The Sweeney, for those who are too young.
Put your trousers on. Yeah. Is that a mirror to your detective life?
No. But I think the Sweeney was a big impact on me joining the police. I just wanted to be a detective when I joined the police. I didn't want to be a chief constable. I didn't want to be a high-ranking officer. I just wanted to be a detective. And I was a constable for 4 years, as a DC for another 6 years after that. So I didn't actually get on that greasy pole until after 10 years service. Because I just loved what I did. I just loved being a detective. So Jack Regan and the Sweeney, though, that's always my number one.
Let's talk about policing and IT, basically. And we have the appeal system, the effectiveness and the efficiency, which I guess if you're effective and you're efficient, that leads on to legitimacy as well, because you're seen as being within reason, legitimate within the communities that you serve. So I've had an interest through the podcast at looking at IT implementation and the management of IT implementation in policing. And I can't help but think that the way particularly case and custody management software has been brought into different forces has had an effect on effectiveness and efficiency in all those forces. Is that something that you'd be looking at as the HMIC as to how well those things are bedding in or not bedding in?
We do look at that. I mean, if you look at two of the forces in Engage, Greater Manchester, one of the key issues for them was their new system. that wasn't bedding in. Metropolitan Police are just putting Connect system in, which might be a very good system. I don't know individual systems that well. Okay. But it's a massive piece of work that can create instability in a force if it's not introduced correctly. Numerous issues around police IT. I mean, I'm not even going to talk about the national issues that we've got with the amount of money that's been spent.
Sure, we've got Airwave, the PNC replacements.
Correct.
And those
problems are widely known. IT implementation in policing is really difficult. One of the reasons for that is the force 3-force approach. There is not enough use made of national procurement to actually identify a system that suits the vast majority of forces, and that's brought in to make sure the connectivity is there so forces can speak to each other, which if you spoke to a member of the public, they would scratch their head the fact that, you know, I'll use two made-up forces, I don't know, West Cheshire and,
yeah,
and North,
Cheshire
North Manchester.
Yes.
They would expect them to be able to communicate together on intelligence, on you know, on other issues that were important. They would expect the police and service to have ability to transfer secret documents quickly from north to south. As we know, that isn't the case.
I have memory of having to go to another force and get an encrypted CD of intelligence and bringing that back into Lancashire, because there was no other way of getting that data across.
People driving up and down, taking encrypted files up and down. You know, it's a bygone age. But the problem is not just the 43 force, it's everyone has their own opinion on what's the best thing to adopt. If I was, if I owned an IT company, I'd be quite happy with the situation, because, you know, they can, pick-off's the wrong word, and they're very professional people who work with policing, but they can dip into different markets rather than having to deal with one person to do the whole contract. Yeah. So financially, it makes no sense. Operationally, it makes no sense. It makes no sense for the public, who can't understand why that is the case, or, to be fair, to most police officers who can't understand why that's the case. So policing IT and the movement, the quick movement on of technology, and it's moving on at a pace at the moment, there needs to be a real grip. So more national procurement needs to be brought in. There needs to be more collaboration between forces when they're identifying what systems they're going to move to, because the system needs to start getting far better than it is around the whole technology side of business.
Glad to hear that. You mentioned you're not able to give directions, but you certainly have a strong nudge.
We do, yeah, we do.
I look and we have the sort of Northgate, Athena stuff that's going on. We have Niche, and then for a while we had Police Works, which at Greater Manchester. The thing I'd be interested in looking at is, often with these systems coming into a constabulary, you will get an awful lot of groundswell from constable, sergeant rank, say what happens in a custody office and how potentially some of the products put grief and glue into the processes there, and it's taking an hour to book a prisoner in where it would be half an hour, where it's taking 3 hours to do a file where it would have been 45 minutes. And I think Greater Manchester is probably a good example of that as any. There was an awful lot of groundswell of opinion from the ground saying, this isn't working for us. And a lot of pushback down from management saying, it will work for you, just not using it right. And eventually they ended up saying, yeah, you were right, it's not right. And are you looking at how the management of that is going to be?
Yeah, we do. We look right through, because obviously it's a big part of their efficiency and their effectiveness. You know, there's no reason why it should take 25 minutes in one force to record a crime and an hour in the neighbouring force.
Yeah.
I mean, that in anyone's view, is not efficient and it's not effective. So chiefs, as I say, need to collaborate more in relation to what is the best technology we can bring in. Not just that's efficient, not that's cheap,
yeah,
but that is effective and easy for the staff to use. Because the data that police produces overall is poor, yeah? So when you're trying to identify some sort of scientific basis for something, you can't, because policing can't tell you two-thirds of what you need to know to do that. And that's because, for me, poorly thought out IT, poorly thought out processes for the officers and the staff who have to input that information. So there's no excuse for it.
No.
And it's frustrating from my perspective.
So, you know, on the front end, as I was a response sergeant for a good chunk of the last part of my service in a city, and having to think, I'm going to have to bring a lot of people back in 2 hours before end of shift just because of the admin burden on the system that they're having to operate.
Absolutely.
And that doesn't serve the people. It doesn't increase our legitimacy, if you will. No. Certainly impacts effectiveness. So it's good to hear that that's something that's in the forefront of, yeah, of the mind, that getting that together, because if you get those benefits, then you're going to save a lot of time, but better class of information. And I've looked at the systems. I'm a bit geeky in the way I did my time on the high-tech crime unit and that kind of thing. They seem very good for auditing. If you're looking from above and you want to drill down through information, there's none of them solved the problem yet of having just the golden record, as they call it. There's duplication of names and addresses and cross links and stuff. And that was never meant to happen, but it did. I'm sure you're aware of them. And
I accept that you're an IT geek. I am the absolute opposite to you, so okay. Don't go but too
you,
deep
but,
into
but
this.
But you will have people that are seconded because
really
of their expertise and there's
great expertise
on with it.
In technology. Yeah. In all different parts of the areas we inspect, we bring people who have got good reputations and are experts in the field.
Yeah, that's good. That's pretty good. So I had looked at talks about the PNC replacements and the impact that has had, and now PND, the Police National Database and Intel Database, is going to be a separate butt-off thing from that. And Airwaves using flexible mobile data, so we can actually have pictures, videos going on and proper encrypted data going backwards and forwards to officers out in the field, and proper encrypted communications being years and billions over budget. But we're all aware of that, and it's something perhaps outside of your purview. It's a national procurement, those things.
Well, a lot of it is national procurement, but we will always inspect against that to make sure that the right things are being brought in and that they are effective and they are efficient.
Finally, we've talked about leadership, haven't we? Personally, I think the rank of sergeant, the first line supervisor, is arguably the most important role within a police service. Considering that rank, do we have a leadership crisis?
I mean, I think the first point to make is, I wouldn't say arguably, because I agree, sergeant is the most important rank in policing. If your sergeants aren't doing the right thing, then chaos ensues, because they are the people that the constables listen to mostly. I can, as a chief constable, I might have all the power, but actually, to get people to do things, you do that through your sergeants. You do that through making sure your supervisors have got the right values, your supervisors have got the right instructions, they know what's important to you, they feel supported, and that they are leading the staff in the right way. Is there a leadership crisis? There are problems with leadership in policing. The training of leadership in policing needs to improve. The College of Policing themselves will say that, and Andy Marsh, the relatively new head of the College of Policing, is doing a lot to address that. The problems you get, in my view, for policing is the disconnect between the top and the front line. So to get from the top to the front line, you've got an awful lot of layers to go through.
I think Andy Rose described it as a permafrost.
It is. It can be a permafrost. You know, unless you work hard as a senior leader at making sure you are very clear with your instructions, you are very simple with your instructions, and that you won't accept any lower than a standards whatsoever, what you do get is a front line who feel disempowered, who feel unloved. You get individual supervisors making up their own rules to how things should be. So you don't get that consistency of approach that any organisation needs, but particularly because of the powers that police officers have, one that's essential for policing. So I wouldn't say it was a crisis, because there's an awful lot of good supervisors and managers out there, and leaders, more importantly. I'm going to say leader, that is sergeant and inspector level leader I'm talking about. But it needs to improve significantly.
I'll come from a position of having been a sergeant's assessor, and assessed sergeants and gone through that with them. There is quite a lot of academics. There's not so much coaching. When I was coming through as a sergeant, I was lucky to work with some exceptional sergeants, and you learn tradecraft and management and ethics and doing it right from that example to some extent. It informs your own practice as a sergeant. There didn't seem to be so much of that in the current system for grading and passing through sergeants. It seems to me to be academic, and wonder if there's a value in putting some more coaching back into it.
Absolutely there is. I mean, you know, you need to have those credible sergeants who are leading these sessions. You need to, if I'm a newly promoted sergeant, I probably know quite a bit about the law.
Yes.
You may disagree, but I'm not sure I need to know all about Cotter's theories and everything else. I need to know the best way to lead those staff. I need to know what processes I need to do to make sure that I do my job as well as possible. So there has been, and I don't say this in any way derogatory of academia, because I'm very honoured to be an adjunct professor. But the academisation, if that's a word, of some of our training is not necessarily the right thing to do. It needs to be more brass tacks. It needs to be more, this is what a good sergeant does, this is what a good inspector does. We used to have an awful lot more of that with sergeant's courses and inspector's courses in the past.
Yeah.
And I'm not swinging the lamp and saying, weren't things great in the past, because they weren't. But more of a mix between the academic and the sort of hands-on, this is what you should be doing, I think, is the way forward.
Yeah, I would agree. I was just very lucky to work with two good sergeants, one from a CID background, one from an operational background, and you pick up stuff from that, and you find your own way of being a sergeant, because that's what you bring to it in the end of the day. But it helps if you have some good examples and some coaching, it does. Yeah.
Well, I think the Army split leadership into three topics, don't they? It's the task, the team, and the individual, and it's a constant balance of... I interviewed a colonel a year or two ago, and he was saying, if you're ignoring the individual to get the task done, you're writing some pretty big IOUs that you're going to have to pay at some point. And that kind of brings me on to leadership and the link between that and well-being at all levels, I suppose. And I think well-being is now part of the Peel inspections. Am I right in that?
You mean, look, you can't be a leader unless you care about well-being. And, you know, to an extent, it's a shame that we have to identify well-being as part of the Peel inspections, because it should be second nature to every senior leader in policing. If your staff aren't 100% mentally and physically, they're not going to do a good enough job for you. They're not going to do what you want them to, which is to protect the public. So looking after that in the best way you possibly can is really, really important. And you mentioned there about the colonel and the task, the individual. You can't just burn people out. You need to be focusing on the individuals themselves as part of that. So it's a balance. So well-being should be at the forefront of every senior officer, certainly every chief constable's mind going through. I know Andy Rhodes is doing some great work around this, and I know we're looking and waiting for the covenant, the policing covenant, to come out still. But there's a far greater focus now on well-being than previously. The only point to make, you know, well-being's real well-being. It's looking after the individuals themselves. It's not the fancy bits on the side. It's not, and I've nothing against any of this. It's not the dogs you bring in to stroke and stuff like that. That all helps, yeah. But it's really focusing on the individual, making sure there's proper mental health support, making sure that if an officer's injured, they can get seen too quickly. They're the things that the officers want. And the officers also want to know, as part of that well-being, that they've got the support of their chiefs. Yeah. So it's a multifaceted issue, well-being. It's not a tick box thing. You know, I don't tick off yet. They've got stroke. Well, they're not called stroking dogs, but whatever. Stroking dogs, Reiki. That's all great. That makes whatever makes people feel better in the workplace, I've always supported. So if people said, if my staff, when I was a chief, said to me, we want some dogs coming in, I said, great, okay, get some dogs coming in, I don't mind that. You know, if they want head massages, yeah, we'll arrange head massages for you. I don't mind what it is, as long as something that's going to make them feel better in work, put them in a better physical and mental place to do the job better. Because at the end of the day, I'm responsible for their welfare, but I'm also responsible for keeping the public safe. And the best way of doing that is to have a focused, professional and fit workforce.
I can think back to three incidences where we've noticed somebody's performance is dipping off. And you talk to them, and initially it's always, no, I'm fine. I'm fine, Sarge, there's nothing wrong, I'm great. Because that's what cops are. They just keep battling ahead and pushing forward and hoping for the best. And then you find out that actually behind the scenes, the life's turned into a country and western song. And it's just not good. But on all those three occasions, the organisation and the Federation and occupational health and everything just wrapped round, and you asked and it was there. And if you're in a good organisation, that's what happens. Everything's there and it's ready to come online for you. And those officers are still in the job and got back to being right. And it took a while, but it's doable. And it, speaking for Lancashire, when I asked the sergeant, this is going very wrong, can we... The help was there and it wrapped around very, very quickly for them. And that's important. Absolutely. And that's the measure of it for me. If it goes wrong, what happens?
Yeah.
And some do it better than others, I'm guessing.
They do.
Yeah.
I mean, I always used to have an analogy for police well-being because the workload is relentless, isn't it?
It is.
At the moment. And it's and if you know the answer to this, you will have solved the police well-being issue. Is. So here's the analogy.
Cool.
How do you service an engine that's running hot without switching it off? Because that is essentially the workload is just coming and coming and coming, and there's no respite, I suppose. That's what I'm trying to say.
There isn't a respite. I agree with you. It's a good analogy to use, actually. You know, if you could just stop everything and start again, you'd do things very differently, like the engine. You know, you could fix it if you could stop it. But it shouldn't prevent us trying.
Just going back to the forces and special measures then. So has he identified any sort of common themes within those organisations that would suggest why they failed in certain areas?
I mean, there's different reasons for them all being in engagements. But there are common themes. Common themes, you know, right along performance frameworks that aren't working, processes that are poor, problems with leadership, whether that's at the very top or throughout the organisation. At times, finance can play a part in it, and the fact that, you know, the funding formula is still a problem, and some forces need more funding than others, but it's not reflected in the current funding formula. But the golden thread running through is usually leadership. And it's not necessarily poor leadership, but it's a disconnect in leadership between frontline, middle managers, and chief officers. And that is a pretty recurrent theme. Most of the forces in Engage have problems responding to calls. Most of the forces in Engage have problems with investigation. And that in itself is symptomatic of a lack of supervision in the right places, maybe resources in the wrong places to deal with those issues. So there's no sort of one overriding, but if I had to choose one, it'd probably be leadership in its widest sense.
Well, I suppose that takes us on then, is are the promotion processes fit for purpose?
Different forces do it different ways. I know the PNAC, the Police National Assessment Centre for Chief Officers, has just been changed. There's going to be a new approach to that next year. We'll see what that's like. We'll give it time. The inspectorate is doing a thematic on leadership over the next 6 months, where we will dive into both how well that is running, this new system, and also leadership right across policing. As a chief and as a senior police officer, it was always a difficult one. What is the best system of promotion? I mean, and some forces go for 3 days worth. When I became ACC in Lancashire, I was here for 3 days.
A three-day lie down.
In Merseyside, it was an hour's interview. Yeah. Which is better? Which produces the better people?
It's almost like the process has overtaken.
The process overtakes
the individual, hasn't it?
And it wants to be all things to all people. At the end of the day, I'm quite convinced I can tell someone's character over an hour's interview. I can pick out whether they're good enough or not. You know, they'll have supporting evidence before you go in there anyway, and you delve into that. You make your inquiries about an individual beforehand, you know, with people you can trust. That's the way to get the right people.
And we see it, don't we? Courses online now, how to pass a police promotion interview. It should be evidence-based, not how you say it.
Well, and that's one of the problems. If it becomes too formulaic, you can be taught how to pass things, and that can't be right.
It's what you do with them after. Whether you identify them as a bare pass or a strong pass or whatever, how they develop themselves, how the organisation helps them to develop, has got to be important as well. I've seen people go from sort of bare minimum sergeant, I'd say one of those myself, to being reasonably good,
yep,
just through the process of becoming a sergeant and learning and developing and getting better. Absolutely. And how do you develop those people? Because you are going to have some bare pass people in your cohorts. Yep. That's just they can't all be superstars or big hit, you know. So how do you develop those so they're still adequate to what you need as an organisation?
But I think one thing that policing hasn't necessarily done well in the past is that you should be promoting people on the basis of their skills at leadership. as opposed to the fact that they're a good egg.
Yeah.
Or
they thief take
a lot of people up. Yeah. So it is. It's about choosing the right people and making sure you're very clear on what you want from your leaders.
One of the frustrations that has been, which I've experienced and has been said to me on many occasions, and again, if you did an objective test with the public, they'd scratch their head and go, what are you doing? I think, will be, you have people in temporary roles who are doing, well, every function is critical, but a critical role, something like a FIM or a tactical commander or a public order commander or something like that, which you take a lot of time to train someone up and get that operational credibility for. Sit in an interview, they've not said that buzzword or that buzzword, oh, sorry, mate, you missed out by half a mark. But go back and keep doing that critical role. That I always thought that was leaving the individual and the organisation a little bit vulnerable, because if their next decision is scrutinised, quite rightly, if there's any Article 2 issues or whatever, that is got to be a point to raise.
Look, I agree with you. I mean, you know, the amount of people that you see who've done protracted temporary roles and done a really good job and then don't pass the interview, that's the time to look at your interview process and see if it's right. Because it's always not asking the right questions if this person is actually exceptionally competent and has been, but just can't get through 45 minutes. There's something wrong. So, I mean, everyone's got opinions on how promotion processes should run, but it's a lot of it's got to be on the current performance of the individual.
Yeah.
And what they've shown to make you believe that they will be a good next step up in the ladder.
The other side of that coin, I suppose, would be if that person is left to sail off in that temporary role and, you know, who's watching them, who's assessing them, who's kind of supporting them, mentoring them, keeping an eye on them, and that trusted source, you as the interviewee might go, you know, how's he, she doing?
Yep.
And I'm sure that conversation should bear a lot for when that person sits in front of you. Doesn't it? But is that actually happening? Has that person been set sail rudderless? And are they actually doing a good job? And who's assessing that? And who's supporting and mentoring that process?
They're the questions I should be getting asked.
Yeah.
Well, finally, it would be remiss of us not to tap into your 36 years, I think, of policing experience from the bottom to the top. What advice would you give to anybody that's just joined the police service?
Just remember why you joined. It's the best job in the world. Which other job? There's very, very few, and I could probably count them on one hand, where you can actually make a difference to someone's life on a daily basis, whether that's a positive difference or negative because you're taking the custody away. But that power that you have has got to be used wisely. You're there for the benefits of the public. You've been given a great opportunity. I think public service is a great thing to do. I mean, I've done it for 38 years now, with 36 years now, 2 years doing this. And it's all I've ever wanted to do. If you put your heart and soul into policing, the rewards you will get back are unbelievable. The enjoyment, the satisfaction, the knowledge that you've done a good thing. There's not many jobs that do that. I think police officers are still exceptionally fortunate to be doing the roles that they're doing. It's a tough job. No one denies it's a tough job. No one denies that there are times when you have a terrible day. But the good days vastly outweigh the bad days if you're doing the job right. So I've got every respect for young police officers these days joining. Some of them, a lot of them, are exceptional in what they do. Don't waste the opportunity to make that difference. Don't become one of the cynics from a young stage in service who says the job's effed. My first day in policing, one of the first things that was said to me by the old sweat in the station at Farm West Street in Kensington, Liverpool, was, hey lad, why are you joining the police? The job's effed.
I bet he was the van driver on the shift, wasn't he?
He was there 38 years ago. So nothing's changed in that respect. Don't be cynical about what you're doing. Treat your victims well. Get after the thieves. Yeah, get after those who are breaking the law and enjoy it. Because if you can't enjoy being a young police officer on response with the opportunities you've got, with the excitement that goes with it, I'm not sure what job you're going to enjoy in the future.
Andy Cook, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.